Yo guys, how's it going? My name is John Steyert. Today is Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013, and it is episode 6.5 of the Social Echoes podcast, The Social Echo Chamber, featuring Jeff Gibbard, the president of True Voice Media. And if you're ready to get rocking and rolling, well, let's get rocking and rolling. So, Jeffrey, how are you?
Hey,
how's it going?
What's happening? Oh, wait, I'm watching us on the other thing. I'm really not good at this. Okay, here we go. I'm back.
All right, cool. Off to a rocking start.
Epic fail on my part. I'm watching myself elsewhere.
So this is a very special edition of Social Echoes. Gave it a different name only because this is Team True Voice Media. Two of the guys that help True Voice Media run smoothly day in, day out. More so the gentleman on the other end of the podcast, Jeff Gibbard, president, founder, and chief strategist of True Voice Media. Jeff, why don't you go ahead and just kind of introduce quickly why you started True Voice Media?
Thank you, John. Wow, good question. So, prior to this, I was working at a PR firm, and turned out to not be the best fit, you know. And coming out on the other side, I began thinking about what's next, and you know, what do I really want to do? So I got the idea of starting this company. I talked it over with my wife, and we said, you know, maybe now's the time. Maybe we try it out. So we came up with she came up with the name of the company, True Voice Media. It took us 6 days. And in 15 days, we had the company up and running. We had our first client within first probably 10 days. And then, you know, it was just off to the races and trying to build this company. Ultimately, I think where I saw there was a need in the marketplace, and the reason I started the company in the way that I did and talking about things in the way that I do, is that I think there's a need in the marketplace for people that are talking about social media in a way that's about more than just likes and followers and things like that. So I saw that there was a need for someone that was really taking social media seriously from a business perspective in Philadelphia, because I didn't see that that really existed. I didn't see too many agencies that were out there that were talking about social media in a way that respects or acknowledges what a fundamental shift it is in the way that human beings are communicating. They really were like, oh, cool, well, this is a place where we can put a press release or we can blast out information. And I just saw that as being only a small fraction, a small piece of what this whole thing is all about. And I wanted to get in on the ground level. I wanted to be a part of how this is changing business, how it's changing politics, how it's changing entertainment, how it's changing everything. And that's why I wanted to start this company instead of joining someone else's, is so that I could help not just be part of the revolution, but help to kind of craft where it's going.
And it's interesting because when I first met you, I met you through Twitter, and when we actually began to kind of start a real life relationship, knowing you face to face, and you explained your vision of what you wanted to do with social business and True Voice Media, I identified with that because that was the first time that I had ever heard anybody kind of really tie them two together. Now, there are a lot of other, national companies that are doing social business. There's different books out on the subject, but really think that Philadelphia, we have a great opportunity to kind of help a lot of different businesses that are, you know, focused in the city and have different arms, either inside the city, outside the city, in different ways. So I was really excited when you asked me to come and join the team, and really am excited to see what we do overall.
Yeah, man, I'm totally with that. And I'll tell you, something that just made me think about is that Philadelphia really is a prime location as an opportunity for social media to really flourish. And there's a couple reasons why. One, we have a very tight-knit community of social media professionals, of the tech community is really, really tight-knit. And all that is because Philadelphia is such a small, manageable city by contrast to some of the larger cities in our country, you know, the New Yorks, the Chicagos, the LAs. Like, Philly is everybody knows everybody, and there's this I really think there's this opportunity for, because we're so small, to really create a culture around taking this whole industry and this whole movement much more seriously than really just playing in that surface zone of wondering, you know, how you're going to pay attention to all those ego metrics and things that don't move the needle or bring in business. We can, I think, by keeping this tight-knit community, having an open dialogue about what's next and where it's all going, we can kind of push the envelope on a national scale by being the city that becomes more socially integrated than anywhere else in the country. Whether or not that'll happen, I have no idea. But I think the opportunity is there because it's a small enough city, it's a manageable enough city, it's a tightly knit city, and you can even see that in our local government in Philadelphia, you know, they really buy in to the whole idea of an open government, a more social government, and I think that that's a culture that if we see it become more pervasive across business in Philly, Philly's going to have a whole different kind of, people are going to look at it in an entirely different way when you can walk around the entire city and get a whole, you know, layers of information from sites like Foursquare or Yelp, where you can, you know, just pop on Twitter and tweet at the mayor or whoever and get a response back. I just think all of those things, if we can cultivate that, it's going to be pretty awesome to see how that puts Philly on the map.
I think the really encouraging thing too is that you're a transplant. You now have adopted Philadelphia as your home. But I mean to bring this up as a serious, like, you know, topic, mm-hmm. only because you come from New York. Like, you're not Manhattan, but you come from New York. A very obviously everything happens there, whatever it is, and media, technology, you name it, it happens there all the time. And to come down here and kind of, you know, obviously you're starting a family here. You have your life is now here, but the fact that you wanted to stay kind of says a lot about the opportunities that you see in the city. And from my perspective, I grew up, you know, in the suburbs and was down in the city all the time with different family members. They owned or have owned businesses in the city limits and in Center City, et cetera. And I got to see just kind of in the last 10, 15 years, just how business has kind of changed and shifted away from the idea that Philadelphia is a town that's kind of stuck in the past. And it's very, very encouraging and very, very heartening for me to read a lot of national articles that kind of are painting Philadelphia in a much better light, a light that really deserves to be painted in, as opposed to, you know, when I was growing up, it was kind of like, you know, Philadelphia was never going to escape the kind of, I don't know, the idea that it wasn't, you know, an evolving city. And I'm glad to see that more and more people are coming to the city to build their businesses, to kind of build their applications, their products, their start their entrepreneurial careers. I think it really kind of is a good roadmap for the city to kind of go on for the next 20-something years.
No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, like I said, I think that the tech community, it's really tight in Philadelphia, and that's encouraging. You're right, I am indeed a transplant. Thanks for the New York shout out. But what I like about Philly is that, you know, it's got a flavor all its own. And I think that's one of the things that I really appreciate about Philly is that it presents opportunities that can only exist, I think, to a certain extent in Philadelphia or cities of kind of comparable size and tightness or whatever, but Philly's got its own sort of flavor to it. And yeah, sure, we're still going to get the snowballs at Santa. We're going to get the, we're fat. We're going to get the, you know, we're the unattractive city or whatever people want to throw at us. But, you know, on the flip side of that, yeah sure, maybe it's a fat city, but we got great restaurants. So, you know, there's that side of it. But then there's also the whole ecosystem that we have that's really thriving here where, you know, Philly's really pushing to become a green city. You know, we've got solar panels on the side of the link now, which is really awesome. There, you know, we're pushing to be really much more tech-centric. The Philadelphia city government is pushing to be much more open and utilize technology. So, you know, I think a good example is back when the whole Occupy movement was happening, Philly was kind of a model of how they were dealing with that whole movement, that the government was in close communication with the organizers. And I thought that that was a real testament to the way that we look at technology in this city, that, you know, we used it to initiate a conversation and to keep the peace a little bit more than we saw in other cities. So I'm really proud of that as a transplanted Philadelphian that, you know, if you look at the past decade, I've been here since 98, you know, the city is really making a lot of steps to make, you know, it's a greener city, it's a cleaner city, it's a more tech savvy city. You know, they're really developing as much as, you know, we have the money to do so. But, you know, I'm proud to say that I'm a Philadelphian at this point. You know, I'm still a Knicks fan, but whatever.
I guess the Sixers are bad enough where you can remain a Knicks fan. But
I got to keep one allegiance, man. I dropped the Mets for the Phillies. I dropped the Rangers for the Flyers.
We can certainly understand the dropping of the Mets. Everybody should drop the Mets. But it's funny that you bring up the Flyers. Because one of the things that I wanted to kind of ask you about was, okay, so the NHL started back up again this weekend. They had that whole drawn-out lockout. Fans were really kind of upset, obviously. You and I are both NHL fans. I am a huge Flyers fan, you know, which is natural for me. I grew up playing hockey. I grew up in Philadelphia. Makes perfect sense. You are a Leafs fan, which, okay, that's fine. They're a great organization. They have a ton of, you know, the original six, ton of history. But here's the thing that I kind of wanted to get into from a social aspect. The NHL, when they first were locked out 7-8 years ago, really did an excellent job rebuilding their brand using the new technologies that were in front of them, the social technologies and kind of the internet 2.0. Now they're still using them, but they can't fall back on the same crutch, which means they're going to have to do something different. They're going to have to be a collective group of social businesses. Now, I know that some of the organizations have tried to do that with different vouchers and things, whether they were sent online or whether you had to go to them in the arenas paying to get them again. You know, the Flyers were good about opening up practices for fans if they wanted to come and see the team, but I still feel like there's a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths. And I just feel like if this was another business, just another run-of-the-mill business, obviously if they had closed for so long, it probably wouldn't have survived. Certainly if it was not a mom-and-pop shop, they would have been done. But let's just say like if a large-scale business that wasn't involved in sports did something similar to what the NHL did, what would be some of the things that you would expect them to do to kind of win back the trust of their fans, their customers, their vendors?
That is an awesome question. So
I win.
I mean, you do win. Here's where I would, you know, first thing, and it's funny because before you ask that question, I'm just thinking about the NHL. I'm thinking like, what could they be doing? How could they be doing it? And then you kind of threw me that curveball where you're asking about a different type of business. But I think that actually the principles remain the same. So in the case of the NHL with this strike and with the lockout that is, and the fact that there's this friction, and here the people, the stakeholders on the outside, the fans, are the people that are pretty much suffering, you know, the most. I mean, you know, salaries notwithstanding of, you know, owners and players. But, you know, the fans are what keep the whole thing going. And, you know, they suffer through it because it's something that, you know, we can all kind of latch on to and we can talk to one another about and kind of congregate around as an idea. But during that lockout, what happened? People became caricatures, right? The owners and Gary Bettman, they all became caricatures. And that's essentially what would happen, I think, in another business is that, you know, on the outside, we don't have enough information. All we see is headlines. All we see is, you know, our vague interpretations of what's out there. So people become caricatures. You know, like if there was a spat at, you know, JetBlue or Southwest or with Virgin with Richard Branson or something, everybody becomes a caricature in that sense. And then the fans have this idea in their head. They've painted this person that, you know, Gary Bettman, it's all Gary Bettman's fault or whatever, which, you know, I'm no fan of him. But I think the only way to bounce back from that, no matter what your business is to remind people that you're human beings and to remind people that at the core of it, there's a lot of complex issues to deal with, because what we see is we don't have hockey. Like, that's what we see. And if, you know, if it had been any other business, all customers would see, all vendors would see, is their own self-interest in the situation. And we lose sight of the fact, I think, that there's a lot of other issues there. So when it comes to the NHL or any other business, I think that the first step to taking to getting rid of that bad blood that's out there is to rehumanize the business, to you know, show that people are real human beings in that space, and you know, show that they went through hardship during it, and that, you know, there really are a concern for the fans. Actually connect with people out in real life, not just online, but you know, go do events, have all of the players out meeting people and doing things. And same thing in the business, get people back out in the community and showing like, hey, we're involved. And, you know, we're sorry we were gone. We did the best we could to get back, but, you know, we're back now and we're here to be part of the community. You got to, like, you know, work your ass off to get yourself back into the hearts and minds of people.
I know the Buffalo Sabres were really good at that. They were the Flyers' opponent on Sunday, this past Sunday, and there was a 12:30 start, which is early for a hockey game, especially on a weekend. But the entire team, the entire coaching staff, the owners, the general manager, actually, the Buffalo Sabres let people in 2.5 hours before game time, and 15 minutes later, the players, the coaches, the front office all went out to visit them. Visit with fans, take photos, do whatever they wanted to until they actually had to go and get warmed up for the game and whatever. Something like that is, I think, really great to rehumanize the brand. And I think the other thing too is, you know, I understand the story of hockey, like what all these guys are playing for, why they want to get back on the ice so bad, is because a lot of these guys are Canadian or they grew up in the northern parts of the United States or in the coldest spots in Russia and Bulgaria, you know, other spots in Scandinavia, and they played on these tiny little rinks, and it just, that's the story of what the business is. That's the human side of it, and, you know, fathers and sons and the camaraderie of it, which can be kind of applied to many other businesses outside of sports. So when people kind of are like, oh, I'm not in sports, it's like, okay, I understand. But like when we watch sports on TV, a lot of the times, a lot of what we're kind of identifying with is the storyline of the entire thing. We're remembering back to those different memories that kind of brought us to be a fan that we are today. And, you know, for me, it was actually playing as a kid. It was going to games with my father. You know, those different human experiences that we all can kind of interact with. And I think a lot of businesses outside of professional athletics can really kind of latch onto it as well.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I would say, in addition to the story, I know for myself, I latch onto the following. I latch onto watching teamwork happen. I latch onto watching somebody give it that little bit of extra. They got nothing left in the tank, and they give that little bit of extra. And that doesn't have to be something physical like in sports, but when you see someone who they've got nothing left in the tank, but they're selfless and give everything they've got till their last, that to me is always exciting. I like watching the strategy. I mean, I grew up primarily playing basketball as my team sport of choice. And when I watch basketball, I watch it differently than I think a lot of people do, because I'm not watching necessarily to see, like, did the ball go into the basket? I'm like watching who's picking who, how are they moving without the ball? You know, who's lazy on the court, who's moving on the court and hustling. Like, I'm looking who's got fast hands. So I'm looking at all different sorts of things that are a testament to the strategy and the planning and the coaching that goes on in that particular sport. And to a certain extent, I see that in other sports. But, you know, take this out of sports for a minute, and when you show teamwork in any company, it's something that people enjoy seeing, I think. When you show that there's a strategy and that there's planning and that you can see that people are prepared for what they're doing, I think that's inspiring. I think that's exciting. And when you see somebody that goes that extra mile, whether it's a story of a customer service rep that, like, you know, sent something to somebody for their inconvenience, or, you know, even though the call center was closed, they stayed like an extra hour to work through somebody's problem. It's that stuff that, yeah, it's you know, it's not sports, but it's the same principles of why I watch sports and the things I like to see. And I think businesses would probably do well to kind of look at those components and work them into the storyline that they're telling.
Yeah. So to get away from sports for the rest of the podcast.
Because I know that we could sink into that, because I know, yeah, what a big sports buff you are, and depending on the sport or the team, I can play along.
Yeah. It's dangerous for me, but I wanted to kind of touch upon that because I felt like it had a real good social business kind of goal that you could kind of latch on to.
Well, I'm looking forward to when you get Caleb on the podcast because you two are just going to geek out with your sports. So those of you listening, if you're a sports person, stay tuned and listen for this one because when Caleb Mezzi gets on here and talks with John Steyer, you might just have like a sports implosion.
You might just run through the entire day and just rip about different stats and people.
Right. You guys will start your podcast at 10 a.m. Let's start with the Phillies. By 2 o'clock, you're like, lunch. Yeah, right. Yeah. Now let's get back to the podcast and let's switch gears to the Flyers.
Yeah. So switching gears very abruptly to Facebook.
That is abrupt.
You wrote a post this last week, at the end of last week, on Facebook's announcement for the graph search and how Facebook is not in competition with Google Plus. Facebook is in competition with Google. And it's funny because I actually, as you know, I interviewed Lynette Young earlier today for episode 6 of Social Echoes. She was a fantastic guest. I encourage everybody to go and listen to that if they would be so kind.
As do I. It was freaking awesome. Lynette is like such a rock star. I'm so glad that we had her on.
Yeah, Lynette was great. And basically, she just was talking about how, you know, she's basically saying that she's not surprised that Facebook rolled this out. She was surprised when it actually came out, the day that it did. But she had been anticipating such a tool that Facebook would kind of roll out.
Yep. It's so funny, actually, you mentioned that, not to interrupt you, but when she was talking about that and she said, like, I have expected them to roll out something like a new profile picture size, I started cracking up because a friend of mine, Jay Stewart, reached out to me and he was like, what are your predictions for today's announcement? And the first things I said to him was like, well, if it's a phone, they're stupid. If it's something to do with timeline or their mobile interface, like, seriously, who cares? But if they're smart, they'll release search. And then they released the graph search, and I was like, bingo, I'm a prophet. I got a crystal ball. So, yeah, it's kind of funny. But I had the same sort of thought. I was like, what sort of stupid nonsense are they going to release? And then they go ahead and release graph search and change the whole game up.
So I think the biggest thing that Lynette touched upon, though, and I really kind of latched onto it, was she said that – so people now can do the same kind of searches that you can do on Google, although it's not the same. The entire – internet, it's the internet that you've kind of created for yourself within Facebook, mm-hmm. and the different likes and the people that you have attached to in the restaurants and et cetera, et cetera. So people can, but the question is, will people search Facebook in the same way they do with Google? I'm not really sure that they will, but obviously that's something that's entirely up for debate.
So are you asking my thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Okay, here's my thoughts on that. I think graph search is one of the biggest things that's hit social, like, ever. Will people use it instead of Google? I think for some searches, absolutely, people will use this instead of Google. Absolutely, no question. And let's not forget that there is a huge population of people that don't have the same critical eye of Facebook that we do. You know, we're in this business. It's our job to hold them accountable, to ask difficult questions, to push the envelope, to all those things. The average Facebook user is grandma. It's my mom. It's, you know, my stepmom is on there constantly. And, you know, it's fantastic that there's something like that that unifies people and allows them to communicate, and it's simple enough that they can understand. At the same time, you know, I've been playing with graph search for several days now. I have it. I got the early access to it. And after using it, I can honestly say I think it's a fantastic tool. For what it does, it is a fantastic tool. And I think there's some overlap between Google and Facebook. And there are some searches where I think the Facebook search is more relevant. And I think, obviously, there's a huge number of searches where Google is much more relevant. Will people use it? I mean, I don't know. People bitch about every single Facebook change that ever happens. Like, will they like this? Probably not. And privacy advocates will probably be up in arms. I think they've done a pretty good job in terms of dealing with that issue. But I think that the reason that it's uncertain is that it's a new behavior. And in general, people don't like new behaviors too often. They either fall into them and it becomes something they do, like checking Facebook when they wake up in the morning. Like, that's a new behavior that no one was like, you should do this. They just, people, that's what they do now. But using graph search is saying, hey, instead of using Google like you're accustomed to, do this. And it's very similar to, I think, some of the issues that that I see Windows 8 could have. Jury is still out, but you're saying, hey, I know you've done this since 1995, but now you're going to do something totally different. Here, use it. And I think that that's an issue for some people. So I think that Facebook Graph Search, it has some incredibly interesting opportunities. When you're looking to see things that you trust your friends about, you know, like, restaurants nearby have good sushi, and you see that someone that you know is a foodie recommended. I'm a foodie, so people trust what I say about food. You can't tell you how many people will reach out to me on Facebook or on Instant Messenger and be like, hey, I'm going to be at like 13th and Walnut. Where should I eat? And then I go, what do you like? And then they're like, well, I was kind of thinking either tapas or this. Like, Facebook could actually completely circumvent that entire conversation by having people that just go and find the places that I like. The issue is that all of this is dependent upon Facebook activity, whereas Google is not as dependent upon other people taking specific actions. You know, my wife doesn't like very many pages on Facebook. I have gone back and forth from liking a whole bunch of stuff because I wanted to see what that experience was like to getting rid of all of my likes because I didn't want to give Facebook any data. So I've swung back and forth, but what's the average user do? What's the general public do? That's going to be what drives whether or not Graph Search is successful, is that the common person may or may not use Graph Search and there may or may not be relevant results.
I think that's probably the biggest thing. The ubiquity of Google, like just Google it, might be the certain winner for the first, 12, 18 months. Obviously, we have no idea, because I think the entire idea of the Facebook Graph Search is terribly exciting, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for it. I'm just waiting to see kind of like, how it's going to be. And I think that's a fine place to be. I don't want to be the guy who's like, every time that a new product comes out, it's like, oh, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen. If it is, then yeah, like, I'm probably going to be very excited about it. I think the Facebook Graph Search is very exciting, has a lot of potential, but because I haven't really delved into it, a whole lot, then I can't really say either way.
My belief of this is that this is what, if they didn't release this, they'd be doomed, because that's just stupid. Facebook is here to stay. But this is the thing that will make their company more successful. It's not timeline. It's not their stupid edge rank and their promoted posts and advertising. It's search. It's search, because that's what we do with the internet. We find things. We find people. We find information. We find knowledge. We find videos. We find funny things. We find entertaining things. We find educational things. That's what we do with the internet, is we go to it to find information and connect. And Facebook, like it or not, owns more of our social graph than any other network. And because of that, and because they're an identity network to a certain extent, that they are what we click on in order to sign into other apps. They are where we go to store our movie and music preferences and everything. Because they have this wealth of data about us, they can do things that other networks can't. For Google to catch up to this, they would have to somehow convince all of us to go through the process of plus-oneing everything that we like, so that they could serve up those same kind of relevant results based on some sort of a recommendation engine. Facebook's natural language capabilities in this, and granted, they're very limited and the number of things you can search are very limited, but it shows a promise beyond something that Google currently has, I think, because it would have to be how somebody kind of keyworded it when they created it, while as Facebook isn't, it's not really about that. It's, a couple of years ago, maybe not a couple of years ago, maybe the beginning of last year, Gary Vaynerchuk said something about how the web is going to be about context, that the like button, the want context idea. If we take the success of the like button and we expand that out and imagine a world 6 years from now where the like button was sort of the genesis of the I want this, I read this, I did this, I walked this. I think of the searches that you could actually do on Facebook that you can't do on Google. You can say, show me pictures of my friends who walked or who hiked Mount Kilimanjaro. They click a button that says, I hiked Mount Kilimanjaro, and then they have pictures. I mean, that's the sort of searches that we could get out of Facebook, and that's something that currently Google can't give us because they don't own the social connections in the same way. And I think that that's partly scary because I don't ever trust Facebook, but I think it's also very exciting because it's something new that will hopefully push Google's innovation forward and hopefully, you know, make this whole ecosystem much more interesting.
And I think to the point of Gary, what you said about Gary Vaynerchuk, you know, the I want, I listened, I read, those are the things that Facebook wants to do. They that's what they kind of, you know, kind of announced when they rolled out the new timeline last year. And obviously it's not here yet, but that is obviously what they want to do. And it sounds like when you first saw it, it was like, okay, that seems to be like a better like button, which is how you just described it. But the biggest thing obviously is both Google and this kind of gets back to your point of the blog post, both Google and Facebook want the same ad dollars from the big boys.
Yeah.
I was trying to find the article that I had read a point I'm about to bring up. Unfortunately, I can't. So to the author, my apologies. But basically, you know, we are not Facebook's customers, right?
No.
Facebook's customers are American Express, are JetBlue, there's Pepsi, Coke, Frito-Lay, Major League Baseball, whatever you want to do. Those big guns are Facebook's customers.
We're a captive audience. We're like a TV audience on Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the easiest way to think of it.
I mean, they go to buy Facebook ads because we are there all the time. Like Lynette Young was saying earlier today, you have a Facebook tab up all day long, whether you are conscious of it or not. So, I mean, you might go and write an email for 15 minutes, and then you're back on Facebook for another 7. You go and go to lunch, and you check your phone on Facebook. It's a constant thing in our lives, and if you have kind of just, you know, it's just like there, it's like, okay, so what's new? What's next? What's going on with this person? What is that person posting? That's a funny photo. And, you know, that's the type of thing that Facebook wants to pull away. They want to pull away the ad dollars from Google so that they can go and begin to drive some of their own products, kind of in the same way that Google has. Google is successful because of AdWords, because of the different ad platforms they have. It's not a secret. And that's what allows them to build Android and Google Drive and Google Docs and things like that, because they're so profitable and because it's so cheap for them to do the AdWords and different advertising platforms that they make so much money off of that because, like you said, search is the internet. So it's going to be very fascinating to see how this all plays out with search and with mobile and who ends up ultimately winning. And it might even be a third party, which would be, I think, the not even that most surprising down the road.
I mean, there's so many things that just bounce around in my head in this conversation. I mean, the one is that they're after the same thing to a certain extent. I mean, they add revenue, but at the same time, they are going at it from completely different directions. You know, Google builds all of these disparate products, the Gmail, the Google Calendar, the Google Reader, the Google Voice, the Google Shopping, all these different things, and then is saying, okay, now we've got Google Plus and an interface that we like, and we're going to tie them all together. And Facebook was like, we have this big thing and everything's tied into it, and they keep adding new things into it rather than, you know, kind of tying it all together after the fact. There's also the fact that Facebook, their approach is get people to Facebook and don't have them leave. Stay on Facebook. While as Google's approach is much more like, there's an entire web out there, but we're always here. We're always part of it. We're always right next to you. That's the Google Chrome strategy. You know, that's the Android, the whole thing. They just want to always be there to service and organize that world's information. So it's so fascinating because to a certain extent, I can't see either side winning because Facebook is not going to get everybody off of the internet at large and everything that is out there and onto Facebook unless they can replicate and bring the entire internet into Facebook, which is not, it's not out of the realm of possibility. And Graph Search has Bing integration. So technically, you could make that your starting point. But Google also isn't going to get people off of Facebook because it's not even a social network that people use now. It's part of a lifestyle. Facebook, like you said, it's what we check in line at the bank. It's how we update people, you know, with where we're going, what we're doing, etc. And, you know, I've tried to kick the Facebook habit, but I can't because every time I post something everywhere, guess where gets the most engagement? Duh, Facebook, because everybody's there. And, you know, I wish it weren't the case. I wish everybody were on Twitter. No, seriously, I wish you were all on Twitter. So please, everyone, get on Twitter. But it's just not the case. So neither side's going to win. They're just going to keep beating at each other and hopefully innovating as a result of it.
The more they innovate, the more that we, the users, the end users, win, hopefully. Not everything is a smashing success, but for the most part, they end up getting it right. Or we yell at them enough until they figure out what they messed up on and they iron it all out.
Yeah. I mean, look, the news feed on Facebook never would have existed without Twitter, right? The cover photos that you now see on Google Plus and Twitter wouldn't have happened without Facebook Timeline. Unified messaging, which still only exists on Facebook and will exist elsewhere, hopefully, please God, Google, get your act together. But that is going to push other other companies forward into creating a unified messaging platform. iOS pushes Android. Android pushes iOS. Then BlackBerry comes in. Windows Phone. So all of these entrants to capture our attention, our usage, our habits, so that they can sell ads or sell hardware or whatever it is. I think it's all fascinating. No real point to that other than I just think that it's fascinating and that this innovation is going to push everybody forward. And it's going to be a wild ride, and I'm really looking forward to it.
So Jeff, what else has got your goat this week? Anything come up on LinkedIn or Facebook, Twitter that's kind of eating at you?
Well, so I did write a post today that was particularly passionate about. I was in a new business meeting recently with a couple partners that we work with, and they brought up that their employers asking for people's Facebook passwords, and I was under the impression that legislation had been passed to fix that, and I was like, there was no way I thought I was wrong about this. I was like, no, that's illegal now. Psh, that's illegal. There was a Password Protection Act, like, it, you can't do that anymore. And she was like, no, I think employers are still doing that. And I was like, stop it. So I started researching it. The act didn't pass. In what world is it okay for any employer to ask for your password to get into your Facebook account? So that's something I'm just, it came to my attention that what I thought had happened actually hadn't happened. And I'm particularly pissed off about it. And I think that it's messed up because I keep seeing this whole world of social media, that we have the ability, the gatekeepers were removed, we've democratized the web, democratized the world to a certain extent by creating this internet, this thing that we can all go to and communicate on a level playing field, and all of the amazing things. I'm not going to go into the whole benefits of the internet, but we have this, and it holds such amazing promise to unite the world, to become a force for good, to all these things. And then we have crap like this, where there are people that think that somehow they're entitled to have access to your private thing so that you can get a job. Instead of it's foreign to me because it would never occur to me that that's something you would do, rather than saying, oh wow, you're on Facebook and you have a huge network, are you willing to use those connections and search through your connections to help benefit the business, to help benefit all of us? Like, I never asked you for anything really about using your own network, but I know that you promote what we do and you talk about what we do and you're passionate about it. And I try to support you and activate you in that because that's the only thing that makes sense to me. So hearing about employers that are asking for passwords, it just drives me bananas because it's just ridiculous. I don't know what else to say about it. It's ridiculous. So that's one thing that's been on my mind. The other thing is that I'm caught in this struggle between wanting to learn about and see about and encourage new innovations and sites to come out and being sick to death of one more social media site coming out. Like, I'm almost like becoming like a wait and see. I'm like progressing out of early adoption because I don't have the time or energy to like wade through another Me Too app or site. So, you know, I see, and here's why I'm struggling with it is that I've recently, you know, over the past like 3 months just been like, ugh, not another site. And then I read this article that had like 7 sites to watch in 2013. And like 5 of them, I was like, wow, that sounds actually really cool. So maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I don't have a problem with new apps or new sites or anything, but I think I'm getting sick of laziness. I think I'm getting sick of laziness on the part of people that, you know, that we may talk to that say, you know, we want you to help us, you know, get more likes. I have a hard time entertaining that conversation. I just want more out of it. I want to talk to them about something bigger. I want them to get more excited about something that can mean something. I'm tired of the laziness in developing apps that do the same thing that another app does. You know, I met with a prospect a while ago that they developed an app, and the app does the same thing that Yelp and several other apps do, but poorly. Who's going to download your app if it doesn't have a reason to exist? So I think I'm getting real tired of the I want to be in this space because it's popular, rather than like take your work seriously and really look for an opportunity. Don't just like phone it in. You know, put a little bit of thought to it. Run the idea by someone, maybe somebody who knows something about the industry, and before you go developing or building things. And look, I've shot down plenty of things that I thought were stupid ideas, turned out to be damn good ideas or very popular. You know, I thought Pinterest was going to be a flop. I was like, Delicious is such a better way to organize things. So what do I know? But I'm just saying, like, I think I just get really tired of the laziness.
I think to your second point, it's almost a lot like eating a lot of sugar. It's like eating a lot of like foods that don't have any nutritional value or something like that, right? You let's say when you first eat it, it's like, yeah, it's like I love this feeling. It's like it's similar to whatever. And that's how it's kind of like, you know, with new social networks that come out, that's how it seems. And then you kind of understand as you go along, like as you get down to the bottom of that bag, or as you continue to eat that garbage for days and days and months and years, and then you're like, I want something substantial. I want something that's going to be like, you know, filling and like, you know, different. And that's what I think a lot of the new sites that are coming out aren't. The ones that aren't social media specific, the ones that are social business technologies, are the most exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that you had shown me the article, and there was a lot of really cool ones in there. One that wasn't in there that I know I had sent over to you that was, I thought, very exciting was one that Jason Falls kind of pointed me in the direction of. It was a company called Guide, and you can find that GUI.de. And basically what they do is they take text and they convert it into moving video and just audio. And I think that's fascinating because I'm someone, one of the reasons I wanted to start this podcast was because I'm such an oral learner. And I've always been, you know, fascinated by radio and just learning by the kind of the context-rich information that audio provides. And a service like that basically for me means that I can absorb more content. And that's what a lot of these types of services are kind of doing. I think another one that I was really excited about, I was talking to my girlfriend with last night, was Ubeam, which basically is like, it's the, oh God, I wish I knew her name, but it's this one young lady entrepreneur who has her degree in like physio neurology or something crazy with the brain. And basically like you can charge up to 3 devices wirelessly almost from anywhere. I would revel in having some kind of device or, you know, plug-in system that would do that. That would be fantastic. I think a lot of people would love that.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the types of things that are going to evolve this decade, basically, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my generation that is kind of equipped to do that. Mitch Joel calls it the makers, or he kind of refers to the makers revolution. It's going to be very fascinating to see how that goes. God, I forget. What was your first point again?
Well, the first one was about, I think the first thing I was talking about was the employers asking for
right.
Facebook passwords.
It's kind of like asking for an email password, isn't it?
I think it's more like tapping your phone or asking to look through your computer. You know,
either way, it's extremely personal, and there's stuff in there that it's for you, and that's the reason why it's yours. There's a reason why it's your password, and you know the sites tell you don't share it with anybody else unless you're really okay with them seeing it, or you know, don't include this as a password that you use for any other site but this one. And granted, I'm not sure how many people actually practice that. I know that I do, but it's something that is, like you mentioned, it's kind of just skeevy, and you're just like, look, there's nothing on here. I'm not like, you know, I'm not doing anything that's so harmful to your business that you need to have access to my personal Facebook account 24/7.
I mean, this is prior to jobs even. These are people that are job applicants are being asked for their passwords. And that to me is just like, it's like shocking. Like, okay, so if you're a parent, I totally understand. You should have all your kids' passwords. And even that is going to be a challenge moving forward because you just can't – it's just almost impossible to track them these days. But to be a boss – not even to be a boss, to be a potential boss and to have the balls to say, give me access to your personal Facebook page is like – it's like incomprehensible to me, to be honest. Like, what could be in there that you're not allowed to see? I mean, it's like, it's just, the possibilities are endless for what you should not be able to see as an employer in there. And part of the thing that I brought up today was in the blog post was, if in job interviews, you're not allowed to ask for certain pieces of information, sexual orientation. I mean, race, a lot of times you can plainly see, but religion, political leanings, all of these different things that you are not allowed to, or it dangerous ground to be asking people. If you get into someone's Facebook, you got almost all of that, depending on who the person is. But I mean, you can find immediately out their sexual orientation if they're having conversations with members of the same sex or opposite sex. They may even be having some really raunchy conversations in there that you shouldn't be seeing. You know, the privacy settings are there for a reason, and the only thing that makes any sense to me is having access to what has been set up for you to see. It's my thoughts on it.
It's a fascinating discussion. It's funny that privacy continues to come up in the podcast. I think it'll be something that we'll probably have to set aside an entire episode on, find somebody out there who's specialized in mobile security or internet security, privacy, et cetera. That would be fun.
I'd love to have a conversation just about privacy. We should do another one and just do like a short podcast where we just talk about privacy, because I find it to be one of the most interesting topics, mainly because I live almost exclusively in public. You know, I have everything out there, but
you're extremely shy.
Clearly. But my concern isn't about people like me. It's about people like, you know, my mom or my grandma or somebody that just doesn't know any better to protect themselves. And they might be divulging things that they don't realize they're divulging because
or
there's
even,
a certain technical prowess that has to happen.
Or even what to do if they have been affected negatively. Like, you know, let's just say either one of us, you know, knock on wood, that it doesn't happen. But let's just say if that happens, we know who to ask, what to ask, what questions to ask, where to backtrack and see where could it have happened, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's what we're trained to do. That's what we look into a lot. And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's just that people need to be aware of what to ask and where to look for ways to protect themselves.
Yep. I think privacy just comes down to it's about choice. It's not about how much is or is not revealed. It's about who has the choice in that matter. You know, some people, I think, choose to live very publicly like I do, where I'm going, what I'm eating, who I'm with, what I'm doing, what I think about things. And other people are much more reserved. But ultimately, that's not the choice of Facebook. It's not the choice of Google. It's not Twitter's choice. It's our choice. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I've always loved Twitter is that there's really no question about it. You're either public or you're private. And even private, they're pretty clear, like, hey, this can pretty easily be copied. And anybody can kind of, infer that, even though we still have politicians and everyone's still getting in trouble with their you know, supposed to be private messaging. But I think it comes down to choice. And that's where I always see whenever there's a privacy issue, it comes down to choice every single time. It's who has the choice in this matter about who sees what. That's when the privacy issues happen.
I would love to pick Richie DiMatteo's brain from Corn on the Job, one of the really good human resource blogs and job hunting blogs out there. I'd love to hear what he had to say on the employers wanted to know about Facebook privacy and passwords. But in the meantime, Jeff, it's time to wrap up.
Cool.
Thank you very much for joining us, joining me on your own company's podcast. The social echo chamber will live on another day in different times and different topics. Jeff, where can people go to be social with you?
People can go to be social with me simply by Googling my name, Jeff Gibbard, G-I-B-B-A-R-D. But if that's not enough, Twitter is the best place to catch me at J Gibbard, J-G-I-B-B-A-R-D. Seriously, just Google me. You'll find me on any site. I use Google Plus, I use Facebook, I use Flickr, I use Instagram, I'm all over the place, but Twitter's my favorite, and just Google me, you'll find me.
Very cool. So that'll do it for episode 6.5 of Social Echoes. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe there, find us on the website at truevoicemedia.com. You can find me on Twitter as well, at JWSTEIERT, at JWSTEIERT. Always happy to talk to folks. If you have an idea for a guest or a topic, please feel free to email me, JON@truevoicemedia.com, John@truevoicemedia.com. And next episode, which might even be recorded tomorrow night, Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013, with Ed Siders of Branded Video. And
awesome.
Ed will be talking about, that'll be a fun episode. Ed will be talking about how video impacts search, social, and your company's story. Looking forward to that podcast. Thank you very much to everybody listening. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
We love